The goal of this class is not to be controversial and not to resolve all the issues, but to give you a sample of different areas where the question of changes in society, how women function in society, were brought up in halakhic contexts and various responses to it. I try not to give away personal positions, since I'm quoting much greater Talmidei Chachamim than myself. But those of you who know me, I will know that the standard extreme positions on one side, the statement when there's rabbinical will, there's rabbinical way, and on the other hand, the taking literally of Rav Hirsch's timeless Torah, that nothing is affected by society, the Torah remains exactly the same, I'm going to show somewhere in the middle, or in between. In the middle is already puts me down. Somewhere in the middle, that things aren't so simple as either. The first case I would like to discuss with you is, and that's on the back of the first page, is a very interesting machlokes, a dispute between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah, where both of whom I'm assuming were written at the very end of the 19th century, though both works, the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah, both works on the Shulchan Aruch, were written in many volumes over a period of time, and you need some historian to tell you at what particular date any specific volume was completed. But I assume the first volume and Aruch Chaim were written fairly early in both cases. It's an appropriate place to start. The Aruch HaShulchan noted that already at this time, which was clearly over 100 years ago, maybe before that, a large majority of Orthodox women, married women, were no longer covering their hair. And this halacha is not discussing whether this is therefore permissible. In fact, he bemoans the fact. But he says the fact nevertheless has a very specific halachic consequence. When it comes to the saying of Kriya Shema or Tefillah, one is not permitted to do so Kineged HaErva. One's not permitted to do so when a, we'll define it as when a woman is insufficiently dressed to the point where what is left out is be considered an erva. There's a machlokas we've shown him whether this applies to women covering their hair, tefach b'isha, or seya b'isha erva applies there or not, but the Shulchan Aruch says it does. Conclusion, according to the Shulchan Aruch, is that if I am in a room where a married woman has not covered her hair, and it's time to say Kriya Shema, I am not permitted to do so. The Aruch HaShulchan says that was true when the majority of women covered their hair. But when the reality in the community changed, and the majority of women no longer covered their hair, even though, as I said, he bemoans that fact, the notion of makom shedarkon lechasas, a place which is normally covered, no longer applies to a married woman's hair, because it's simply no longer true. It's not darkon lechasos, because the majority of them don't cover their hair. So the first source, Rav Shulchan says, v'ata above and itzavech al prisas dareinu, v'avnosenu harabim. He obviously isn't pleased by the development. Harbe shezeh shonim rabos shenifritu v'nos rabavon zeh. Mind you, he says many years, and he probably wrote this before 1900. So you see how far back this issue took place. And that many of the women have gone no longer covering their hair, and no matter how much it was screamed about, it didn't help. And then he gives sources, right? It's no longer an area that is covered, since the majority of women don't cover, married women don't cover their hair, even if that behavior is not halakhically correct. But the consequences of the halacha, that you know that one is not permitted to say Kriya Shema in front of a woman with uncovered hair, it's no longer true. The Mishneh Brura, this is all on Siman Ayin Hay in Hilchos Kriya Shema, it discusses places where one is not permitted to say Kriya Shema. The Mishneh Brura rejects what the Aruch HaShulchan says, though he doesn't refer to him by name. Shedarka lechasosa vafilum ein darka lechasosa rak b'shuk v'b'bayis v'chotzer mikomakam v'chal ervuhu l'chula alma afil b'bayis v'asa shav mikras negda. The Mishneh Brura goes to another extreme. From the Gemara in Ksubis, it would appear that the requirement that women, married women, cover their hair is in the outside and not true in the privacy of their home. Mishneh Brura says it doesn't matter when it comes to the prohibition of saying Krishma even in the home, where perhaps there's no isa for the going out in the first place, it's still considered an error and it was not to say Krishma. And he continues. Alright? V'da'od, afilum derech isha zo, v'chavuseha ba'osa mokom, lelech b'gili rosh b'shuk, derech ha'prutzos, osu. Right? Doesn't make any difference. Right? It makes no difference that people don't do that. Right? The Mishneh Brura says, it matters little what people do. The halacha says you're not permitted to do so. So it's a erva, and even if all the women around don't cover their hair, and it's a common phenomenon, it doesn't change anything. We have this machlokas. Now, interesting is the comment of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe discusses this in three tshuvos. I picked the last of one. You'll see why specifically. In the context of his discussion of how high a mechitza has to be in a shul. And he discusses the question whether what is the purpose of the mechitza in the shul? Is it so the men should not see the women? Or is it so they should be separated? And concludes that a mechitza should be 5 feet high. Where do you get the 5 feet, the 60 inches? On the assumption that if a woman is standing, that the size of an average woman would be that only her head would be above the mechitza. That the 5 feet, look at some of the tall women, the short women are going to say, what am I talking about? That their body up to the head will be still under the mechitza, only the head will be out. Why should that be sufficient? Isn't there a problem that some of the women will come to shul, they won't cover their hair? Aside, when I was a young man, and it was uncommon for married women in the Orthodox community to cover their hair, almost all, they certainly did so in shul. But Rav Moshe apparently was aware of a situation of women who didn't do so in the synagogue as well. And he said, well, that's not a problem, because I happen to agree with the Aruch HaShulchan. and he has a proof supporting it, I'm not going to go into it. And that's the first two tshuvas. This certain size of a mechitza has to cover through the shoulders, doesn't have to cover the head of the woman, because what's the problem? Even if she doesn't cover her hair, it doesn't cause any problem for people to say Kriya Shema and Brachas anyway. Because I agree with the Mishnah, with the Aruch HaShulchan, clearly against the Mishnah Berurah. In the third volume of the Aruch Chaim, he was asked a very interesting question by the chief rabbi of Sioux City, Iowa. This is quite some time ago, obviously. And an interesting suggestion came up. The women wanted a lower mechitza, and they knew that Rav Moshe said a higher mechitza, so someone had a brainstorm. If we make the women's section 1 foot higher than the men's section, so then we can make a mechitza for the women only 40 inches, well, it's 50 inches for the men. I actually... 60 inches for the women, while it's only 40 inches, it has to be 20 inches high. The raise, I'm sorry, my arithmetic's getting bad. 20 inch difference, they'll be happy it's only 40 inches, and technically it's 60 inches, so we solve the problem, the height of the mechitza. I actually, my wife and I don't know if she remembers, spent the Shabbos in a shul, this must be 25 years ago, which did it that way, right? It was a way of balancing different needs in the shul. By making the women's section raised a little bit, the women felt that they were not so isolated. From the men's section, it was 60 inches high. From the women's section, it was only 40 inches. So he says, technically, with respect to mechitza, you beat the system. Even though the Chacham are not really happy about this clever kind of plans, but then he says, but there's another problem. And look in the second half of his tshuva. Aval ein ruach acham noch mizeh. The afshe kima b'zeh inyan ha-mechitza. He says, as far as mechitza is concerned, technically it's good enough. Mikom akam haruvan hochosh shelo b'tznius b'zroos megulos v'gam yos mizeh b'vaseinu harabin. Said the problem is that you can have women coming to shul sleeveless and with low décolletage, and so great from the standard of mechitza, it's okay, but you can't say any brachos. You won't be able to say krishma because the way women are. What should be striking us? Rav Moshe just said that the reason the mechitza doesn't have to be higher than 5 feet is because we are paskin like the Aruch HaShulchan, and we don't care about the fact that they should have covered their hair. It's now it's no longer makom that's normally megula, because most women go that way. So I imagine in Sioux City, no insult to anybody from Sioux City, that the problem was that most of the women went sleeveless in the summer. So why is any different? So Rav Moshe says, but that's erva mamish. The chula alma sedaf harifa rabba mamekilin b'saras harosh lini krishma otfila. The divrei Torah. Va'af la'orcha shulchan. Sha'af la'osrin yesh la'hokov b'zman hazeh. K'shiruv mevarasen harabim ein machasas roshan. Af shal v'shish v'raisa. Va'ani abesi ragdol v'vav. That even those who say women's covering hair was never a factor in krishma, the Rambam and the Rif, and even the Aruch HaShulchan that said, even though we would pass against the fact that Bizman Azed no longer, because most of them don't cover their hair. And I brought earlier what I think is a strong proof that the Aruch Shulchan is correct. I am the Sifri Shamsim in the Beis, Mikovim is Rose Magulos, Afim Rov Hanashim Prutza Shalachasan, who Erva Shaasal Espalo, the Likra Kriyashma, recall Vivre Torah Kinegda. Aruch HaShulchan says the fact that women dress differently bizman hazeh affects some things but not others. There's a line here, right? apparently to the Aruch HaShulchan, the prohibition of davening where women have uncovered hair is somehow less of a real erva than women who go sleeveless. And since it's less than a real erva, we can take into account that people now, women no longer cover their hair. However, when it comes to a real erva, right, over here, then it makes no difference. Interesting. Just leave it for what it is. And I'll just leave you with a question. Right. From the time that these tshuvas were written until today, the number of women in the Orthodox community who cover their hair has grown tremendously. Question. You would go back. You say, okay, the Aruch HaShulchan was right then. Right? But now, it's changed. Now the women cover their hair. It's no longer a rove. And therefore, that which the Aruch HaShulchan and Rav Moshe permitted, perhaps should not become asur again. Remember, if you let social change operate, it doesn't only go in one direction. Right? Here it goes in a different direction. I'm not going to answer the question. Yes?
I'm just wondering, would we be looking only at the Orthodox women? Would we be looking at all Jewish women?
I'm glad you asked the question, because that is one of the issues that comes up in all discussions of social change, looking at society, which society are we looking at, right? And we will see, and it'll come up in some of the later cases more clearly, that they're very different societies. Whenever we're going to talk about issues of tznius, right, privacy, so we know that in Bnei Brak, and in Muncie, and certainly in New Square, they prohibit women from driving because it's not tsanua for women to drive. Right? I would imagine that for the overwhelming majority of people in this room, perhaps 100%, that sounds absurd. What does that have to do with tznius, women driving a car? Maybe you should discuss how many people should sit in the car and where they should sit. But driving a car, why is that not tznius, right? So whether the notion of society, even if we say it's Jewish society, even if we say it's Orthodox Jewish society, does it vary from community to community, from subculture to subculture? It's a very good question that I personally don't have a good answer for. Right? The second case involves courtesy. Right? The Gemara says that a man should not walk behind a woman on the street. Interesting, two of the great poskim in Yerushalayim of the last generation, the Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Waldenberg, and the Minchas Shlomo, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, discuss the following scenario. You're going on a bus in Israel, and a woman who's, let's say, she's a wife of a Talmud Chacham, Eishes Chavik Chaver, you're supposed to honor her, or in general, it's considered in polite society, in courteous society, to let the woman go on the bus in front of you. Should you do so or not? After all, you're not supposed to go behind a woman in the street. So Shlomo Zalman writes an answer saying, he quotes a very interesting work, that's the other side of the page, called the Leket Yosher. The Leket Yosher was a pupil of the Truma Sedeshin, so we're going back in time a number of centuries. And he apparently followed the Truma Sedeshin around and saw what he did. Right? He was Boswell to the Truma Sedeshin's Johnson before there was a Boswell for Johnson. And he said that the issue came up, and the Truma Sedeshin said there's no longer an Easter of walking behind a woman in the street. And he explains as follows. The terminology in the Gemara is Poga Isha Beshuk. He somehow found a woman, saw a woman in the market, meaning that it was an uncommon phenomenon in the time of the Gemara that women were out in the marketplace. That was the culture. And you saw one, and then if you walked behind her, that was meant you were trying to look her over, and it was improper, and therefore it was usur. However, in modern times, meaning the 16th century, right, the time between the Dashes, where there are a lot of women out in the street, probably see more women out in the street than men, right? Many women out in the street, and it makes no sense anymore, because if you're going to walk, run ahead of one woman, you'll be behind the woman ahead of her. You'll never pass everybody, enough people. So it no longer applies. It no longer applies. Based on that single source, Shlomo Zalman concludes, and four lines from the bottom, okay, hey, nearly the remarkable mitzvah. Oh, shitzorach lasos came mitzad hanimus. Either tzorach mitzvah was the eshes chaver. I guess in Osir, because we'd have a woman as a chavera also, but, alright, someone who's learned, or out of politeness, derech hanimus. Out of courtesy, what's considered polite in society. Ein tam lahachmed bizman. Right. He says, therefore, it no longer applies in our time. Right. Again, society has changed. Now, when the Gemara says, you shouldn't walk behind a woman, the Gemara didn't mention anything. He's trying to, dayek the word pagayish v'shut, but the Gemara doesn't say. It seems to derive it from a pasuk in Nach. That it's no longer applicable. Right. Second case. The third case I want to bring to your attention is one that everybody knows. But I'm concerned about formulation. It's well known that the Chafetz Chaim gave his stamp of approval. Remember, the Chafetz Chaim, the same person who wrote the Mishnah Berurah. Right? Chafetz Chaim gave his stamp of approval to the Beis Yaakov movement. What was the issue? The issue is the Gemara in Sota has a machlokas tanaim, a Mishnah in Sota, where the women, when a man is supposed to teach his daughter Torah or not, and the poskim all seem to paskin the view of Rabbi Eliezer that a man should not teach his daughter Torah. Then we have the formulation of the Rambam, as is well known. I'm not going to go into all that. It's brought in the Shulchan Aruch that a man shouldn't teach his daughter Torah. It's somehow worse if it's Torah Shabbat Peh than Torah Shabbat Ksav, but even Torah Shabbat Ksav, he shouldn't do the Chatchil. Shouldn't do. Now the question is, on what basis did the Mishnah Berurah approve of the school system of Beis Yaakov? Now, if we look at earlier commentaries, we'll find that there are ways of getting around the position of the Rambam. The Rambam talks about Rov Nashim, and therefore the Prisha already writes that if a woman demonstrates her ability to learn, then it would not apply to her. And the reason the Rambam talks about teaching your daughter is because when she starts out, how do you know what category is going to fall into? But once some women show that they have the ability to understand and to learn, things change. And clearly there have always been learned women. But a school system means you want everybody to go to school. Clearly, when Sora Schneer started the Beis Yaakov movement, there wasn't an entrance requirement for the 5 and 6 year olds to see what level of understanding of Torah they have. Right? The goal of the Beis Yaakov movement was, obviously you can't get everybody to do it, but the goal was to get everybody to go. Right. Now, so instead of looking at the letter of approval that the Mishnah Berurah, that the Chafetz Chaim wrote just before he passed away in 1933. I want to look instead at the Likutei Halachos. Likutei Halachos is a halachic work by the Chafetz Chaim, written, that came out in a number of editions, came out over many, many years, and a number of editions. And what I'm going to quote to you is not found in any of the earlier editions. It's so obviously so because it's a footnote. It's a ha'ara, right? There's three stars before it. It's a later footnote. In fact, I had a tough time finding it. Even going to the library, luckily you can get online every possible edition of everything if you know how to do it. And one of the librarians, Moshe Shpira, I'll give him credit, not only found it online, but printed it out from the offline. Without my even to find it, I couldn't find it in our library. I couldn't find an edition that has it. So if you look at the text of the Likutei Halachos, look in the middle, and then explanation on the side, before we get to the footnotes, the Mishnah Berurah says, because of Rabbi Vaha, he raises an interesting question. An interesting question, technically, that the Gemara would seem to imply that the position that prohibits women learning Rabbi Eliezer is a minority opinion. Because the Gemara refers to those who disagree with Rabbi Eliezer as Rabbana. It would appear that it's a minority opinion. He says, however, all the poskim take it as the way we poskim, despite the question. Then he concludes, V'chein halacha, alright? As far as Rabbi Eliezer, even though the Gemara seems to indicate that the Rabbanan disagree, V'chein halacha, we pass on Rabbi Eliezer, you shouldn't teach a woman Torah. V'kosu rivusa, the hainu da, meaning the Rambam, hainu daf v'torah shabar peh. Habal torah shabaksav, avshein l'lamda, l'chadchila, makomokam hamalamda, enik malamda tiflus, women should learn the dinim that apply to them. Because obviously they can't carry them out if they don't know them. But otherwise, there's a level of difference between Torah Shabbat and Torah Shabbat Peh, but you shouldn't teach both. Footnote. I think this came in the last edition before Chafetz Chaim passed away. I do not know what year the Chafetz Chaim wrote this. Ha'ara. Venera, the third one. Right? The Choze Dafka Bizmanim Shilafonenu. She called Echar Hayador Bimokam Avosav the Kabbalah Sa'avos Hayachazok Chazok Ma'ov. When did the Gemara refer to? In what historical period do we say that you were not permitted to teach a daughter Torah in school? In the generations before us. Because everyone lived with their parents, right? We know in Europe there were towns where Jews lived in the same place for hundreds upon hundreds of years, and the same buildings and generations lived together. The Kabbalah Sa'avos Hayachazak Me'od, and the tradition of the parents were very powerful. Everybody followed it. Right? Says, if when the generations lived together and there was real continuity in Jewish life, and the children followed in the path of their parents, then it made sense to say that the women don't have to get educated in Torah because they will simply follow the pattern of their parents. They will continue to function in the same way and therefore will keep mitzvahs exactly like their parents do. Avo, ke'eis baboseinu harabim. Notice that phrase from them. Arach Ashochen also, Shakabala Sa'avos Nisrofeif Ma'od Ma'od, the influence of the parents have weakened very, very much, right? It's rough, ma'od, ma'od. But gam motzui she'enu dar b'makam avosav, and the children no longer live there, right? They're all singles living on in Washington Heights. Cloud, right? Turn the page. Ubifrat osan shemargilin atzman lilmot tzav v'loshon ha'amim, and those who have been trained to study the writings and the language of the non-Jews, right? Hinting at those going to the secular schools. Bevadai mitzvah rabba lalamdam chumish v'gam nevim uksuvrim umusrei chazal gam mesachas avos me'as hamar kedom kedesh yis ames etzlam inyan amunosenu akdosha yilavachi olish yasuru lagamri miderach Hashem v'yavro ko yisod yadas chas v'sholom. He said, it's a great mitzvah to formally teach them. Teach them Torah Shebiksav, teach them Pirkei Avos, which my calculation is still in Torah Shebaal Peh. So it's a different criterion which he's applying, right? Because otherwise we're going to lose them completely. So the same Mishneh Berurah, the same Chabetz Chaim, who in the Mishneh Berurah says, it doesn't matter that the women don't cover their hair. The halacha said they should cover their hair. You can't say Krishna. It doesn't change. However, here, the implications are far greater. Right? So, why I read it to you instead of just telling you something that I'm sure most of you are familiar with, is the formulation. The Chafetz Chaim says, because of the change in society, because women are going to secular schools and learning foreign cultures, and because the influence of the parents is not what it was earlier, the halacha changes. And under these circumstances, not only is it permissible for girls to learn Torah, it becomes an obligation, a mitzvah rabba, a great mitzvah to teach them. Now, this is not the occasion for the debate as to what should be taught to women in different contexts. In our time, when women have a much greater secular education than the Chafetz Chaim was certainly referring to in his time, that's for a different occasion and different setting. You know, just read between the lines in resolutions at RCA conventions. My point is that we're looking at the same Chafetz Chaim when it comes to certain matters. He says, if society changes in a manner that I don't approve, that's not going to cause the halacha to respond at all. The halacha is going to remain exactly the same. And in other situations, he says, when I see the consequences of the change as very dangerous for religious life, then I say we change what the halacha says and reverse it. Now, again, if we go back to the example I gave for Rabbi Moshe, where he differentiates between women not covering their hair and women going sleeveless, we have to determine what specific criteria are used by the various poskim, what judgment they're using, and who has the right to make these distinctions. The last case I want to discuss with you, make life easy for everybody, I have a lot of material in English, because this stuff has been translated. The historical background is the following. In 1919, the Yishuv in Eretz Israel, obviously the Yishuv HaChadash, right? The settlement of Jews in Israel, after the Balfour Declaration, felt that they had to organize and have some kind of government, some kind of representation. Obviously, it's almost 30 years before the State of Israel, so it's not a real government, but a representation. how are they going to have a representation? Well, they're going to have people vote, some kind of democratic process. If we step out of what was then Palestine and look at the world at that time, what is a major issue in democracies about voting around 1920? Women's voting. Right? So we find that in a number of Western countries, European countries, in America, the rules are changing, and women are starting to vote in elections. In the Middle East, this is not happening. Who are the leadership of the yeshuv? Well, not then and not now, they weren't Sephardic Eastern Jews. Right? The leadership of the Israeli government to this day is overwhelmingly Ashkenaz. Doesn't mean German in this case, but European. Of European background, it certainly was true then. And the leadership, as we know, was very much liberal, if not socialistic, already. Therefore, it certainly came from the elements in society that would want women to vote in the election. The question comes up now about the rabbinic leadership. And here we're going to find something that I found absolutely astonishing. A dispute between... Let me just shut it. Okay. I should have done that earlier. A dispute between Rav Kook and Rav Uziel. Remember when the state actually when we get a chief rabbi, Rav Kook becomes the Ashkenazic chief rabbi, and Rav Uziel becomes the second Sephardic chief rabbi. At this point, he's already chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. And they're both dealing with this question. And what's absolutely astonishing is not that they come to opposite conclusions, but it's the way they come to the conclusions. And just as an aside, at that time, and subsequently in these areas, the Ashkenazic Rabbanim, right, coming from Europe, are the ones who consistently oppose women doing new things. Even though the Ashkenazic world is the world where women do these things, the Sephardic rabbis consistently approve. Even though in the countries they came from, women certainly didn't vote, women didn't participate actively in society. It's an irony. The problem in both these poskim responding to the question is that frankly there are no sources. The question doesn't seem to be discussed any earlier. I'm not talking about the question of women serving in the government. That already gets to the whole question of Srora, of the whole question of Melech Lo Malka, the Rambam. That already, the discussion in Tosfos, women can be judges and not, that already has sources. But the issue of voting, hard to say that any particular voter has Srora means power, control. Right? It's one vote, another vote. It's just one vote. Right? What's the issue? What is the issue in voting? Now, from our perspective, we probably don't even understand what the issue is. Right? What was the issue then? Why was it such an issue around the world? Because it represented women taking on a very different role in society. Women are no longer subservient to their husbands, right? Their vote counts the same as their husband's vote. Trust the secret ballot, right? Right? They help determine the leadership of their country, of the society. So if you look first at the two tshuvas from Rav Kook, you find that Rav Kook, sometimes it's page 2 of 12, it's the second to the last paragraph. And it's interesting is Rav Kook doesn't differentiate between voting and getting elected. It's not even an issue in the whole tshuva. He never differentiates. Right? He says, I have nothing to add to the words of the rabbis who came before me. In the Torah, in the prophets, in the writings of the Ksuvim, in the Halacha, and in the Agada, we hear a single voice. The duty of fixed public service falls upon men. It's a men's manner to dominate, and a woman's a manner to dominate. The ultimate of judgment, of testimony, not Torah, etc. Therefore, thus, any innovation in public leadership necessarily brings about mixing of the sexes in a multitude, in the same group, in gathering, in the routine course of people's life, is certainly against the law. Right? To Rav Kook, there's no question, it's usur. Right? Absolutely usur. There's no, it's not a thing to discuss, there's no opinion that possibly thinks it's mutter. Usur, usur, usur. Possible. Inconceivable. And then he discusses why it's not for the good of society to have women vote, you know, because what's going to happen? Right? Alright, no, that's in the second tshuva, a very interesting one. He says, what's going to happen? If women work, if women vote like their husbands, so it's not a good thing, but they're not going to be expressing themselves. And if they vote against their husband, it's going to cause, disharmony, it's going to destroy shalom bayis, it's going to be a terrible thing. Right. Now, and who are the people pushing women voting? European culture. We're letting European culture dominate instead of our own culture, our own values, our own morality. By the way, one can hear echoes of this argument in a totally different context amongst the followers of the son of Rav Kook in Israel, dismissing European morality, European ethics, as we have our own. I don't have enough time, but you can certainly read, everybody can read it all in English. But then let's go to the response of Rav Uzziah. Alright? So he separates the two, between the right to vote and the right to be elected. Again, the second to last paragraph on the page. Right. Regarding the first heading, we find no clear ground to prohibit this, and it's inconceivable that women should be denied this personal right. For these elections, we elevate leaders upon us and empower representatives to speak in our name, to organize the matters of our yeshuv, and to levy taxes on our property. The women, whether directly or indirectly, accept the authority of these representatives and obey their public and national directives and laws. How then can one simultaneously pull the rope from both ends, lay upon them the duty to obey those elected by the people, yet deny them the right to vote in the elections? Put into American terminology, right? No taxation without representation. How could we possibly prohibit the women? Right? Then a lengthy tshuva by Rav Uzziel about women getting elected and serving in the government. That he quotes sources, he quotes opinions one way and the other. And he distinguishes between people elected and people appointed, whether it's for lifetime or a whole very complex halakhic analysis. But when it came to voting, what did we find? To Rav Kook, it was obviously prohibited. To Rav Uzziel, it was obviously permitted. They couldn't even have a dialogue. There was nothing in common between the two positions. Right. When we talked about the second one of serving, which we won't have time to discuss, you can read what they say, and there's much later written in more recent sources, that their sources and their reasons to give this argument and that argument and their different opinions when it comes to voting, it's ethereal, there's nothing there, and yet Rav Kook takes it as obvious that women shouldn't vote, and Rav Uzziel says it's obvious that women should vote. today, Israel, America, name your country, Orthodox Jewish community, Haredi community, do women vote? Clearly. The only community that opposes women's voting in Israel are those who oppose the men voting as well. Right? Those who don't recognize the government says that no one should vote. And I'll go one step further. I once saw from one of the Meshi Zahavs, the one who founded Zaka, saying that our women should be allowed to vote. Only our men shouldn't be allowed to vote to protest the government. What has changed? The obvious answer is a very practical thing. If the Orthodox community has the men voting and not the women voting, and the non-Orthodox community has the men voting and the women voting, our representation and influence obviously is going to decrease by 50%. Right? It's just simply not livable. If we're participating in the system, if we're voting, if we want to have any influence on the results of the vote, then we can't do so losing in advance potentially half our voters. And suddenly the psak of Rav Kook, not of Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, not of the Kanoim, that everybody agrees that it's prohibited, one doesn't hear a word about it. Because society has changed in such a way that the price that we pay for fighting this battle would be disastrous. I should also point out, though you can notice it on your own, that the whole thing seems strange to us because we live in a society where many women work. Even those who don't work don't shop over the internet. They actually go into stores and go outside and mix in society. And the notion that their privacy is going to be offended by every few years standing on a line, which we all do many times, and then going into a sealed booth with no one else there, hopefully, and voting in a secret ballot, to us, literally makes no sense whatsoever. Right? It's like, it's even more absurd to us than the people in Maybach not driving cars. A driving car is a more public kind of thing, right? But voting, you don't vote every day, right? You do it every once in, depending on the system, every few years. It's meant to be private because people are not supposed to look at who we're voting for. So the whole notion that this is a problem disappeared totally from the scene, right? So this is one area where the change in society simply eliminated this. It's only because some people recently decided they wanted to, show their scholarship and say, you think Rav Kook was so liberal, look what he wrote truth about women voting, and therefore disappeared in various publications. This thing became a topic for discussion. If I want to put the different pieces together and end basically on time, and you note again, I was very careful not to quote any of the poskim who seem to reflect the more modern Orthodox community, with the exception of Rav Kook, and Rav Kook's actual relationship to what we call modern Orthodoxy is very complex, even though he's quoted all the time by modern Orthodox people. It's a complex mix in different areas, in certain women's areas. He was rather conservative. In fact, his son is quoted, Rav Aviner, who was a student of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, quotes in the name of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook that he loved the Mishnah Brura. There are only two areas he disagreed. I don't remember the other, but one of them was that the Mishnah Brura was such a maker and says that women only have to cover their knees, where Rav Tzvi Yehuda thinks that women should cover their ankles. So the Rav Kooks, you know, and certain issues had, you know, don't put people in boxes. Never works well. Alright? We see that the halachic poskim are aware of and responsive to society changes. But responsive to doesn't always mean that they change accordingly. It can mean in some cases that they say we have to reevaluate. Now, mind you, in almost all these areas, the halacha that's discussed is not a mitzvah in the Torah, where we can say, you know, we have a mitzvah, and the mitzvah said this is mutter and this is asur, but areas that are not so clear in its origins, though we have to be careful in saying that, I don't want to generalize too much, and said in some situations their response is we respond to and react accordingly. In other situations and or other poskim, the reaction is to move away. And I'm going to quote, there's a woman, a Jewish anthropologist in Israel, whose field is not some Indian tribe, but whose field is Orthodox Jewish women and the effect of Limra Torah, of women learning Torah. Her name is Tamar Elor. And she wrote two books that I know of, both of which have been translated into English for people who have difficulty with the Hebrew book. And they deal with, one, her dissertation, Maskilotu Burot. I'm going to translate it, not her translation, but as it translates to me now, Educated and Ignorant, about the effect of serious Torah education in the Haredi community for women. And the second book, Lishana Pesach Haba, describes the effect of the growth of Torah learning in the modern, or the religious Zionist community, using Israeli categories, where women, and she differentiates greatly between the consequences of the learning in both communities. And when she describes the learning in the Haredi community, she quotes the principal at that time of the Beis Yaakov Seminary in Bnei Brak, who said that we are educating our Jewish girls to be like their grandmothers who were not educated. Paradox, right? And that would be consistent with the implication of the Chafetz Chaim, right? The purpose of this education is to somehow get back to the world when they listen to their parents. And in fact, one of the interesting things in that book, and I see my time is up, is that it describes a post-seminary classes for a group of, she describes, post-seminary class for a group of women in the Ger community. So first of all, the fact that these are women in the Ger Hasidic community who have gone to school through elementary school, high school, and seminary, and are taking post-seminary classes, so they're taking a lot of years of Jewish education, a class in halacha where there seems to be a problem between the teacher and the class, because the teacher keeps on quoting sources, halachic sources, and the women respond, this is not what my mother has told me. This is not what I heard from my father. This is not what I heard from my grandmother. Right? So that you still see the conflict between the notion of tradition, what they got from their ancestors in a community which has stayed closed, and what it says in the text. While in the, when it comes to the modern Orthodox community, she sees it as a quiet revolution. If you're interested in pursuing it, just read her books, and you can either agree or disagree with the conclusions. Thank you very much.